Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below.
Okay, so welcome to the conference. A couple of little safety things as we're talking about trauma for 90 minutes. If it feels too much for you at any point, if you find yourself freezing, not breathing, feel free to stand up, to move, to take a break, to look for a friend. There's different things you can do. You don't have to sat still in your chair the whole time. So always say that ahead of trauma ones, because people tend to go there. So I was a very wild teenager, and I had all sorts of addictive issues, all kinds of trauma in my childhood. And my mum said at 16, she could see that I needed something. So she said, let's go to India. I'm going to take you to India. And I said, cool, mum. My mum was a nun, you see, before that. So I thought, cool, mum. Okay. You know, we didn't have much money, but she somehow scraped this together. And I'd also just fallen in love for the first time. And I was getting that horribly wrong because I had all kinds of intimacy issues, or, you know, because of trauma. And in India, I couldn't find any good music to listen to, except there was this one singer called Alanis Morissette on MTV at the time. And she had this album called Jagged Little Pill that had just come out that was at the time super famous. And there was something in her work that I resonated with me on a slightly deeper level than a lot of the kind of popular music that was about. I had this deep memory of discovering yoga and meditation and being in love for the first time while listening to Alanis Morissette. And I eventually realized that things like yoga and meditation weren't the only way to heal your trauma, though, you know, certainly useful. Got into martial arts, and then eventually discovered the work of these people here. I think one of Peter Levine's books was one of the very first trauma books that I read. Certain neuroscience came in, people like Dan Segal and interpersonal neurobiology, that aspect. And I discovered Gabor Mate's work and realized this was all going on in this social context, and things like inequality and racism and things like that were actually really important as well. And the last person in this group that I discovered actually was Richard Swartz, who I met up with in San Francisco and just immediately felt at ease and at home with. And I trust my body with that. So I haven't explored his internal family systems as much as the music work of the others. Interestingly, when we were putting the conference together, someone said, you should get a pop star, you should get someone famous. And I said, but I'm not going to get anyone. They have to know about the work. You're not just going to randomly grab a pop star from the street. And then someone said, well, have you checked out Alanis Morissette's podcast? And I went, no, what do you mean? She's got a podcast. And I looked it up, and she had like nearly all my trauma heroes on her podcast. And I listened to several episodes, and I was like, wow, this woman really knows her stuff. She knows her interview questions are fantastic. She's clearly deeply researched this in her own experience. And that sort of intuition about her psychological / kind of spiritual sense that I maybe got at 16 listening to her music made sense to me, that she'd gotten into that. I was like, okay, great. This is the person we really want. And Stephanie managed it. So again, kudos to Stephanie. And, you know, I always said when I was 16, I was going to marry Alanis Morissette. That never happened. But she is at the conference, and I do have an amazing wife, you know, who's not here. So it's all worked out. It's all worked out beautifully. And I've ended up leading this panel of these amazing teachers today. So excuse my boring little story. I hope that wasn't too indulgent. And it's introduced them in a way that's a bit better than just saying they wrote this great book and they have, you know, Pete Levine founded Somatic Experiencing. You all know that. You all know about Gabor's books and Dan Segal's lectures. You all know that. So I'm going to host this. I'm going to try and be fair and ask a question. I'll start off with just what is trauma? There we go. That should keep us going for 2 hours. And I'm going to time it. Okay. And the order you're on my screen is Alanis, Richard, Peter, Gabor, Dan. And it'll be 2 minutes each. And I'm going to be strict. Okay. That's going to be quite hard because I hold some of you in some awe. But I will set an alarm on my phone to sort of beep after 2 minutes for the first question. So why don't we just go straight in there at the deep end. What is trauma to you, Alanis Morissette?
Trauma to me is anything that keeps me from living from my essential self, capital S. And I'm pretty obsessed with developmentalism. So I look at the areas of trauma in my personal history, and they seem to chart the course of, you know, the attachment stage. There can be some tasks that were left undone, to say the least, neglect or abuse around that. The exploration stage, just based on Margaret Mahler and some of the developmentalists and Harville Hendricks. The exploration identity, I think this is a culture that is egregiously under mirrored and under touched. So competence, all these stages of development, in some ways, sometimes all of them are touched on, sometimes some of the tasks are left undone, and the work that can be done, thankfully, because developmentalism is a non-linear thing when it needs to be, we can really remember and heal through adult relationships, which is the best news, because although the saying goes that we can't repeat our childhood, in some ways we can absolutely correct and repair in our adult relationships, and so much about how to show up as a parent as well. I could continue, but that's a little start.
Boom, with 45 seconds to spare. Richard, what is trauma?
So for me, trauma is less about the actual event and more about the impact it has on your inner world. So there'd be a difficult event, but if instead of locking up the parts of you that got hurt by it, you go to those parts and embrace them and listen to them and help them heal in the moment, then the event doesn't become traumatizing. So trauma isn't inherently traumatizing, is the point I'm making. If instead, though, the event makes some parts of you, and this is my world, is all these different subpersonalities that I call parts. So some parts of you, particularly the most vulnerable parts, get very hurt by the traumatic event, or shamed, or terrified. And in response, you lock them away inside because you don't want to feel any of that anymore. You want to move on, So it's insult to injury to these young, vulnerable inner children. They were hurt by the trauma, and now they're abandoned by you, and you then become more vulnerable because other things could trigger that. And so you have all these other parts that are forced into protective roles. And people lose trust in what Alanis was saying, that this, what I call the self with a capital S, because the self couldn't protect you from the trauma. So it's that impact of forcing these parts that are, before they were hurt, are inherently valuable in all of us, into these very extreme roles, and losing trust in your what I'm calling yourself. So bingo, I did it.
Please, perfect timing. Thank you, Richard. Peter Levine. What is trauma?
Okay, doke. In 2 minute version. Trauma is when we're overwhelmed beyond our capacity to rebound. When we're not like the willow tree in the wind that can bend and then can return. And this is something that happens in our mind, our brain, and our body. And that was my initial, is still my primary interest, of what goes on in the body when we're traumatized, and how can we change that experience in the body. So you can't erase the trauma, it doesn't make sense, but you can be able to experience different sensations and feelings that contradict those of overwhelming helplessness. And, you know, I think about Freud's original definition of trauma. Of course, he trained changed in a way that really betrayed so many of his patients. But when he first defined trauma, I think it was about 1916, when he said that trauma occurs when trauma is a breach in the protective barrier against stimulation, leading to feelings of overwhelming helplessness. And I would just add to that or change it, that trauma is what happens when there's a breach in our protective barrier against overstimulation, leading to feelings of overwhelming helplessness. The other thing about trauma, which I think you've all touched on, is it's not just what happened, of course, but it's also what happened in the absence of an empathic other, who somebody was there with you to help you move through these difficult sensations and feelings. And in an unspoken voice, the first chapter is when I got hit by a car and I was laying on the pavement, and I know what I needed to do, because you know I've given that kind of first aid to enough.
Really tricky for me, but I want to be scrupulously fair here. So okay. Sorry, moving on to Gabor.
Okay.
Well, being in the presence of three people that I've learned from about trauma, first of all, from Dan about how early experience affects brain development, from Peter about trauma as a disconnection from the self, from the world, and as he said recently, from our vitality, and Dick about the fragmentation of the self. Rather than defining trauma, I'd like to talk about, as a physician, as a medical doctor, how I've seen its manifestations, because this is not appreciated in the medical profession. In fact, it's the biggest kept secret, despite only 10,000 research papers and studies showing the relationship between trauma and illness. So trauma shows up in all manner of afflictions, diseases, in addictions saliently, in what we call mental illness of all kinds, but this is less appreciated also in physiological illness. Because trauma, when it happens, and as everybody says, it's what happens inside the body, affects not just the mind in an abstract sense. Dan is very clear how the mind is a process, an embodied process. So it happens in the body. So whether it comes to ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or autoimmune diseases of all kinds, multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, chronic asthma. Let me give you a quick example, which I mentioned maybe last week when I spoke. The more racism an American Black woman experiences, the greater her risk for asthma. But what is that if not a traumatic effect? In Canadian studies that show that men sexually abused have at least 50% in childhood, have a 50% increase in their risk for cancer, regardless of whether they smoke or drink or not. Studies that show, a study last year that showed that women with PTSD have doubled the risk of ovarian cancer. And trauma results in a suppression of our emotions. Dick talks about the protectors, the man that manages us by pushing down our emotions. Well, women who push down their anger are much more likely to suffer the pain of fibromyalgia.
Okay. Thank you,
Gabor. So I'm talking about the physical manifestations here, and thank you.
Dan.
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Mark. And I just want to say I share such honor to be with all of you on the screen, and I've learned from every single one of you. I would just say in terms of this question, you know, there's a fundamental process when you take a step back and kind of link all the different disciplines of science together and do, you know, this thing we call interpersonal neurobiology, which is to say that there's a process called integration, which is defined as differentiated parts of a system being linked together. And it looks like well-being emerges from integration, just like Gabor is talking about, you know, these impediments when we have societal problems or environmental problems can be seen as impediments to integration. So the simple way of, from an interpersonal neurobiology point of view, of talking about trauma is it's something that has sustained attacks on the capacity to integrate. So from Peter's point of view, that might be what we talk about rebounding and resilience. From Dick's point of view, it would be about how you have different parts that are differentiated and then linked. And Alanis and I have done a lot of teaching together, and I think that fits with a lot of your experiences too, Alanis. And so what I would say about trauma is when you have impaired integration, you see chaos or you see rigidity or both. So unresolved trauma would reveal itself as chaos or rigidity inside the body. You see it also inside the brain and the head as a part of the body. You'd see it in one-on-one relationships. You'd see it in families. You'd see it in classrooms. You'd see it in organizations. And I absolutely agree, I think, with the sentiment of everyone, which from an attachment point of view, there's something called epistemic trust, which is how we come to trust authority figures in conveying what is true. And so in a way, our larger modern culture is traumatizing us because we're living a lie of a separate solo self. And Mark, I don't know if that means my time is up or you're giving me 30 second warning.
Thanks, Dan. That is so brilliant. I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to be fair.
Then I'll just finish that sentence. You know, the separate solo self, I think, is a lie that is traumatizing everyone, period.
Thank you all. So one thing I've noticed is in panels, there can be a sense of acceleration and sort of like not enough time from panelists and also people watching. So I'm going to suggest between each kind of question, maybe we take a breath or even just a 3 second pause. Okay, next question. Let's do 3 minutes for this, so it's a little bit more spacious. What is the role of the body in trauma, as we're at the embodiment conference? Alanis.
3 minutes. For me, the role of the body is to keep the current that moves through me, to be responsible for the speed at which it moves, to be responsible for it, rather just keeping an eye out on sublimation versus dramatization and actings out. You know, having the space, you know, I create space through disidentification and inner dialoguing allows me, we did it together also, Richard, being able to dialogue with different parts that are affected and that are acting out. So for me, Gabor, I loved what you said about the immune system being so intensely impacted by trauma. And that's one of my biggest fears when I think about that which I haven't integrated yet, Dan, or that which I haven't you know, dialogued with or sought some wisdom from, these inner parts, this multitudinous world of inside of me. And the question again, Mark, just to be reminded in my brain.
Yeah, no, the role of the body in trauma.
Say again, oh, the body. So for me personally, it's about being responsible for the current. And I think another topic that is often underrepresented in trauma conversations, as I see it, is the temperament, you know, the highly sensitive temperament, the, you know, the part of us that is an empath, for those of us, 4% supposedly, 4% of the 20 or 30% of people are highly sensitive temperamentally as a trait. So I keep that in mind. I don't want to make my sensitivity or the intensity of sensation and feeling in my body get so intense that sometimes I'm overstimulated, like you mentioned, Peter, not just from outside, but I get overstimulated from the content and the stimulation on the inside too. So for me to be aware of my body as the resting place or the seat of the self sitting there, ideally communicating with these parts that are acting out or freezing or armoring or attempting to protect this system, sometimes in ways that are non-relational, sometimes in ways that are confusing for people, confusing for me even. And then really having a real idea of what mental illness is beyond DSM, like understanding that these personality disorders that we see in all areas of politics and culture in general are born from different attachment styles and attachment adaptations. So for me, it's about returning and correcting or repairing in as best of a way as we possibly can in a therapeutic context, in group. The dancing, Andrea Juhan does a beautiful model called Open Floor, where it integrates a lot of, integrates movement and et cetera. To be continued.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Richard, body in trauma.
Yeah, well, to pick up, and first I want to say, I didn't get a chance to say that. I'm on this panel, I'm so honored because these are all my heroes in the field. There's a couple other guys, but and women, but it's just great to be with you guys. So to pick up on what I was saying earlier, after a trauma, there are parts that get locked away that I call exiles, and there are other parts that become protectors. And to control you, the protectors will often use your body in different ways. So if you're facing some kind of a threatening situation, you might get this terrible headache. And this is a lot along the lines of what Gabor was talking about. And it's coming, if you focus on the pain itself and get curious about it, you'll find that it's coming from a part of you that's really wanting you not to do this risky thing and doesn't know how to get through to you other than to give you this big headache. And then there are these exiled parts who would have no other options to get a message through to you than to screw up your body in some way or another. So the body becomes a kind of a message board in many ways, or an access, a way these parts try to control us. And we do a lot of work with medical symptoms quite successfully, various kinds. I did a big outcome study with rheumatoid arthritis, for example, and had the patients focus on the pain in their hands, and they found parts that hated the big caretaking part that wouldn't let them take care of themselves. And Gabor would agree with that, I think. And the other impact is that what Alanis has called the self, what Dan calls the hub of the wheel, is what I call the self with a capital S. And it can be more or less embodied. And after trauma, parts tend to push that self out and don't trust its leadership anymore, or trust it a lot less because it didn't protect you when you were a kid. And if the self can't embody, it can't lead in the way it should. So the body embodiment in that sense of parts trusting it's safe to let yourself, this essence with all these great qualities, back into your body after a trauma can be quite a sales job. So do I have time left?
24 seconds.
Oh, okay. So what else would I say? Also, if you want to get to know a part, like say you're trying to work with your critic, the first question we'll ask is, where do you find that in your body or around your body? And most people can immediately locate it in their body and from that place have a dialogue with it. And instead of thinking of the answer when they ask the critic why it does this, I'll say, just let the answer come from that place in your body and don't think about the answer. And they'll start to get really pure. Okay.
Thank you, Richard. So Peter, what is the role of the body in trauma?
Yes, the question of what happens in the theater of the body. And Gabor, in his book, When the Body Says No, really talks a lot of this kind of expression, how it comes out in these specific syndromes and symptoms and illnesses. So body and trauma. There's the anatomical body, the physiological body, they're all very important. But there's also the living, vital, sensing body. And it's about our life energy and how this life energy becomes dissociated, fragments. Dick, you were talking about some of the ways it fragments. And or there's great suppression. And this is the work really of Wilhelm Reich, a student of Freud's. And when we're not in contact with our life energy, our life force, for a long time, I really hesitated to even use those kind of terms, because when I was trying to see how somatic experiencing could be more accepted in the mainstream of psychology and medicine and so forth. So I wouldn't talk about that. But now I cannot not talk about it. Also, what Alana said, which is a very important point, is that trauma affects us in very different ways depending on our temperament. So we may, for example, be very physical, mesomorphic, and so forth, and the trauma affects us in one way. Or we're very thin or narrow, that we often experience trauma in the schizoid way of fragmentation and dissociation. And then also the person who has this kind of rounder structure, and they're more in tune with their visceral sense in terms of relationships. So there's so much to know, but ultimately really what we need to know is that every person is their unique self, absolutely unique self. And that trauma sometimes is a way, an avenue, a portal to open into that deep self. I think all of us have somewhat spoke about the self with the capital S, the purposeful teleological movement of the organism through its life style, life style. And also it's a disorder in not being able to be in the here and now, and you can't be in the here and now when you're not connected to the body sense. So I think I probably used up my time.
Perfect, Peter. Thank you.
Okay. Gabor. I am trainable.
Gabor, role of the body in trauma.
You know, I'm asked that question and I find that the spoke of my wheel of awareness just wants to move around the circle and bring in so many things. So it's hard to select what to say really on such a vast subject. But let me begin with a quote that's quite well known by Alice Miller. And this is the very last paragraph of her book, Thou Shalt Not Be Aware. And she says, the truth of what our childhood is stored up in our body, and although we can repress it, we can never alter it. Our intellect can be deceived, our feelings manipulated, our perceptions confused, and our body tricked with medication. But someday the body will present its bill, for it is as incorruptible as a child, who still whole in spirit will accept no compromises or excuses, and it will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. So the body is a record of everything that's happened to us. And of course, when we talk about body, we have to really keep in mind that there's no body separate from the mind. That's really, it's the mind body that we're talking about. And I've taken Dan's concept of interpersonal neurobiology to really talk about interpersonal biology, because our relationships affect our bodies as they're doing at this very moment. So the body in a sense is a record, and so it's also our teacher. So when and Mark, I'll ask you to give me lift your fingers when I got 20 seconds to go, okay? Otherwise I have a hard time keeping track. So when somebody has multiple sclerosis and they have a flare up, they could see that as a misfortune and run for more medication. Or they can say, what is my body trying to tell me? And I'm telling you from personal experience with multiple people, when people are willing to learn from the body, when they're willing to listen, look at the record that the body's keeping, and they can actually help to mitigate and prevent other flare ups. So the body is our greatest teacher, but in our culture, for all kinds of reasons, we're so disconnected from our bodies. And that's one of the impacts of trauma, as Peter will tell you. So in healing, we need to use the body. And so, for example, one of my mantras is, whenever there's tension, it requires attention. So when I have tension, it's not just a mental experience. It's actually happening in my belly and in my chest, in my throat. Thank you. If I pay attention to it, the body will tell me what is it about myself that I'm ignoring. In other words, what traumatic imprint is being acted out. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabor. And I'll take on this 20-second finger warning from now to help. Dan.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. You know, Peter and I were once interviewed for a documentary, and Felitti was there, Vincent Felitti, who was the lead investigator for the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And I said to Vincent, I said, we were hanging out before the camera started rolling, I said, so in this study, which shows that if you're traumatized in childhood or you have these overwhelming experiences, you have all these serious medical problems that Gabor has powerfully written about, you know, was that an intervention study? He goes, oh, no, no, no. We just did an epidemiological study. I said, well, did you ask the question, did any of your research subjects actually do the inner work of resolving trauma? And he goes, no, no, that's not what we do. So when you do an analysis of the likely mechanisms, and Alanis, this is to really speak to your concern that you so powerfully expressed. If you look at the likely mechanisms where the body holds trauma, they would include increased stress with cortisol hormone, right? Elevated, that could be damaging. It would include damaging your ability to fight off infection with your immune system compromised. It would include compromising how your heart and your chest works with your head, so your cardiovascular system. It would increase inflammation by altering the epigenetic regulators that lead to inflammation, which is now understood to be a main source of certain forms of diabetes and even cancer. And the fifth thing is it would whittle down the caps on your chromosomes, the telomeres, to make it so you age more quickly. So stress and aging both whittle down these things. Now, here's the key thing. We have research now which takes those five molecular mechanisms of health that are the likely ways trauma early on leads to long-term problems. And we know from what's called three-pillar practice that if you train your mind to focus attention, to open awareness, and build kind intention, all five of those, not in people who have been traumatized, that study hasn't been done yet, but in the general population, all five of those are enhanced. In addition to those five molecular ways, the specific ways that are likely the cause of a negative effect, the way we use our mind can improve them. The sixth thing to know about is you can actually integrate your brain more so that adverse experiences, as Marty Teicher has shown, you know, when they're severe, they lead to compromises in integration. Got it, Mark. And so what we want to do is promote the growth of integration in the brain. All six of those things you can do, and I know you as a friend, you have been doing them. You can keep on doing them so that you cultivate the very mental states that heal trauma and heal these molecular mechanisms.
Hey, wow. Whew. I feel like I'm dining at five wonderful restaurants simultaneously. So let's take 30 seconds to stretch, to move, letting go of that kind of acceleration and scarcity. Make a noise.
Like the cat. The gatto.
loving the cat.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the third of sort of three intro questions, and then I'll go to the questions of some of the participants. So third one, I think another 3 minutes, we'll do another round, and then we'll make it a bit freer for the participants' questions. How do you heal trauma? How do you heal trauma? So Alanis has kind of got the tough gig here going first with these questions.
3 minutes and how to heal trauma.
Back, or are you okay to start again?
Okay. So how do I heal trauma? For me, it's a juicy, large toolkit, and it really depends on what's happening. It may be a process of doing work with the inner parts for me, having dialogues. It can be, for me, very much beneficial in the healing direction, heat and water and sun. The seasonal affect disorder comes in, so that doesn't help the process. Being across from a safe and non-judgmental listener, wisdom helps, knowledge helps, therapy, had copious amounts of therapy, and I give therapists and therapy credit for my still being alive, because there's some, there's healing to be had in the therapeutic relationship if it's held and safe. And I thank therapists all the time and every opportunity I get. movement also when I'm on stage performing in front of people, just having that sort of receptivity to the energy careening through me at different speeds, usually allowing that energy to move. And it could just be around the joints and the wrist and the moving. Gabor, once you said to me, I think you said to me at one point that there will be a finish line in the healing and the recovery. I personally have a sense that I might be on this trauma recovery journey until I'm 128, but you believed otherwise, which was very inspiring for me to hear. What else can I say about the healing process for me? Writing and art has been very, very therapeutic and cathartic. Not always healing if I'm using art as a way to avoid relationality or the mirror neuron melting and warmth that can come from sitting across from love, basically. So for me, it's bringing myself back from thinking art is the panacea and realizing that if I could take the courage that I apply in the writing of these songs or the writing of these pieces to my day-to-day relationships and letting them move me, letting my relationships break open parts of me that have been frozen and armored. I do so in my marriage, in my best friendships. You know, the thought is that the degree of commitment and the degree of intimacy and vulnerability is commensurate to the degree of healing that is available. So as best as I, and as often as I can, a little harder to do in this context of pandemic time, but as often as I can, just dive into that relationality and allow the vulnerability to be what it is. And really returning, it's like that beautiful sun metaphor. I just think that ourselves, capital S, is the sun, and life and the vicissitudes are the clouds that go by, but the sun never moves.
Lovely, thank you.
Thank you.
How do you heal trauma?
So I'll piggyback on the term Dan used, which is integration. So as I was saying earlier, trauma has the effect of making you lock away the parts that got hurt the most, and then other parts take over and totally blend and take over your body and your mind that are trying to protect you. And so it's a process of honoring those protective parts, even though they're often giving you symptoms that bother you or that can screw other people, going inside, listening to them, hearing how they're trying to protect you, and getting permission from them to go to the parts that were hurt so badly by the trauma and are still frozen in time in that trauma. And then from this place I call self, with a lot of compassion and curiosity, going to those parts that you left in the dust and witnessing what happened and how bad it was from this open-hearted place. So you become a compassionate witness to your own traumatic history. And then actually going into the scene and being with that, often a child, in the way he or she needed at the time, and actually sometimes dealing with the abuser for the child, watches, and then taking that child to a safe, comfortable place, where at which point most of these parts are willing to give up the emotions and beliefs they've been carrying for even 40 years, at which point they'll transform into their naturally lighthearted childhood states. And then you can bring the protectors in to see they don't have to do this. And so you're bringing integration to this very fragmented system. And now they're starting to trust you more as a leader. And so that's kind of countering all the impacts of trauma. And some people can do all of that by themselves, but many people need the presence of a self-led, open-hearted therapist to guide them through that process. But and all of that does literally heal and transform the trauma such that you don't have to just cope with it anymore. You actually don't feel any of that anymore.
Thank you, Richard. Peter, how do you heal trauma?
Yeah. Right. That is a question.
3 minutes.
That is the question. You know, I'm just thinking and writing, you know, a godzillion, well, at least a bunch of different books about trauma and healing from trauma. And I was at a place where I didn't know what my next writing project would be, because I have graphophilia. It seems like I have a compulsion to write, but it's important. It's been important for me. And with the support, the guidance from a number of friends and colleagues, they have asked me to encourage me to write an autobiography, my story of my own healing. And at first, this was very difficult, the whole idea of it. And I started writing it, and I thought, well, anyhow, you know, there's a Jewish saying, what is truer than truth? Answer, the story. And so this autobiography is about my story, folded into many other stories, like the nested Russian dolls, one within each other, within each other, within each other. And my beginning was rough. You know, our family, long story, but were being pursued by the mafia. And they could have very easily murdered our family. And this went on for many, many years. So it really eroded my sense of goodness in the world. And then also around that time of being beaten up and raped by a bunch of gang members to send a message to the family to not testify. So, and I thought, what are some of the things that really got me through this? And I think that even though with this trauma and with really a neglect of adequate empathy, my curiosity was always valued. And I learned really to just, I was the, you know, the annoying perpetual why kid. Why is this? Why is that? Why is this sky blue? Or because of that? Well, then why is that? Why is that? Why is that? And I was receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the USAVP. And I was surprised that my brother, John, was there. He's the one who discovered the endorphin-mediated placebo response. And I always felt that he thought that my work was so somehow unscientific. And so I was very surprised when I saw him in the audience. And I talked a little bit about my curiosity, my drive for curiosity. And he said, after we had some dinner afterwards, some lunch afterwards, he said, yes, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but well, when I was about 10 years old, 10, 11 years old, I lived on my grandfather's farm, and we had a wagon, and we would take the produce that was grown, and we would go to a bungalow colony a couple of miles down the road and sell them. And on the way back, we had sold everything except one head of cabbage. And as my brother pulled the wagon, I saw the cabbage roll to the back. And I was curious about that. So I stood by the side of the wagon as my brother pulled the wagon. And I realized that the head of cabbage didn't go backwards. It stayed exactly where it was as the wagon went forward. And when I returned and I asked my mother, why did this happen? This happens every time we do this, the same thing happens. And she said, well, Peter, you just discovered Newton's first law of motion. And I've always been in motion in developing the work and in teaching it now throughout the world. When I started teaching it, it was to a group of about a dozen Berkeley therapists in my treehouse in Wildcat Canyon. And I tried to find ways to explain what I was doing, why I was doing it in a way that was transferable. And it was a great deal of frustration for me. But with encouragement again from this study group, I continued to work on it. And then I was absolutely stunned, because in my mind, that's really the group that I've taught to, this group of 12 or 15 therapists. And when somebody said, well, you know, this work has now been taught to 50,000 people worldwide, I couldn't fathom it. So I have two burning questions. One question now is, have I done enough? And I feel the answer is yes. You know, there are 40 teachers that are carrying this work into the world and doing a magnificent job. The other question, am I enough? And that's the one that's still a work in progress. Given my history of trauma and also incredible, wonderful things that have happened, I really keep asking myself, who am I? Am I enough? So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's a little bit about my journey.
Peter, thank you so much for sharing. I bent time and space there. So that was 3 minutes for sure. Much appreciated, Peter, to the sharing. So Gabor, how do you heal trauma?
Well, first of all, Alanis, I have to confess something. If I give you the impression that I thought that there was some endpoint, that's just the opposite of what I actually believe. And I've actually written my own epitaph, which is, and my gravestone, it's going to be engraved. It was a lot more work than I had anticipated. And I expect to keep doing that work for a long, well, I hope for a long time yet.
Okay, I was speaking, cool. I must have misunderstood.
I was speaking with a woman called Edith Egger, who's a 92-year-old Auschwitz survivor, and she's written a therapist in California. She's still working, and she wrote a book called most recently called The Gift, and it just came out a couple of months ago. And she was on the same train to Auschwitz that my grandparents were on, mm-hmm. and her parents. Now, she survived, all the others did not. And I said to her, Edie, I haven't got over it yet. And she said, don't worry, you never will. But you relate to it differently. And so healing is not getting over anything. It's about how we relate to it in the present moment. And a person missing from this conversation, but very much present, I think, in spirit, is Bessel van der Kolk. And Bessel and I were having lunch together once in New York at a beautiful conference, nutritious lunch, lovely sunny day. And Bessel peered over his glasses and he said to me from across the table, Gabor, you don't have to keep dragging Auschwitz around with you everywhere you go. Now, in another context and spoken in another tone, that could have been an insult and a put down. It wasn't. It was pure loving guidance. Mm. Why? Because there was compassion in it. Mm. And one of my teachers says, only when compassion is present will people allow themselves to see the truth. Mm. So I think the essence of healing, about which I'm gonna say something in a moment, is the presence of compassion. And compassion for others, for the world, and for ourselves. And that means just that curiosity that Dick was talking about, for everything and every part of us and every part of every other person as well, including the people that we most dislike and even detest. There's always a reason why people are the way they are. And that reason is always some hurt. And that's where the compassion comes in. And when that talks about integration, when Dan talks about integration, what occurs to me is the very meaning of the word healing. And meaning of the word healing comes from an old word for wholeness. So really healing is integration. Healing is wholeness. Healing is restoring that disconnection that Peter says is at the heart of trauma. And the beauty of it is that if trauma isn't what happened to us, but what happened inside of us, that means it's always available for healing. Because if trauma was what happened to us, what happened to me 75 years ago, it's gone, it's finished. I can't undo what happened, but I can certainly reverse what happened to me as a result inside of myself. And let me tell you a couple of interesting facts. I mentioned this study about ovarian cancer and PTSD. You know what's interesting? In that same study, women who'd had PTSD, but who'd had some therapy for it, had less of a chance of ovarian cancer. In other words, the therapy actually helped to reverse the physiology along all the parameters of inflammation and telomeres and epigenetics and everything else that Dan was talking about. And let me tell you one more interesting study, which is about right-wing political points of view. Now, it turns out that the more active your fear center is, the amygdala, the more right-wing you're likely to be. And in this research, they looked at men, and men who had been traumatized, physically beaten in childhood, they were much more likely to favor capital punishment, to be in favor of foreign wars, and to be violently anti-abortion. Some of those men.
I'm going to step in. I want to keep a little sense of fairness here.
I got 5 seconds, okay? Those men that had been violently beaten as kids, but had had therapy, they were softer in their points of view. So healing is that softening that compassion can bring.
Thank you, Gabor. So last but not least, Dan, how do you heal trauma?
Thank you. Well, you know, in 3 minutes, I would just start with a simple sentence. You know, if the impairment to integration in our lives, whether it's our bodies, the body and the brain, our relationships, our culture, is impairments to integration, then the path to healing is integrative in the ways I think everyone here is talking about. So I'll just start with the pitch to the pandemic that some unpublished research, to build on what you're saying, Gabor, you know, shows that the more aroused we are, and this really works with Peter's powerful work, the more aroused our systems are on fight, flight, freeze, and faint, the more depression and anxiety we're going to have, and less resilience we'll have to deal with the physical isolation that we have in this pandemic, even though we should absolutely be getting rid of the word social distancing and replace it for physical distancing, because we need to maintain our social connection, even though we have to not share the air during the pandemic. You know, and when you look deeply at, and I'll just make a pitch for Dick's powerful work, even some brain studies that used IFS, you know, that Dick showed me when we were in Belfast, and I met with a leading researcher on that, you know, there's really a ton of evidence to show that when you identify your different aspects, your parts, your facets, and do this internal focused work that, for example, somatic experiencing does, you shift the way things are. And that's the healing process, is literally to bring in the differentiated aspects and link them together. So Peter, when I've seen you do powerful workshop examples, you know, you're really having people hold in consciousness the many elements of experience. And Dick, for you, holding in consciousness the many aspects of ourselves. And Gabor, for you, you know, holding in consciousness these ways that the world is affecting us, even on a cultural level. And Alanis, I think when you see people writing it about your songs, and your last album was absolutely fantastic. I have one of the songs rolling around my head, so I'm going to blame you for that. You know, but it's a beautiful thing when you really deeply dive into your songs. You're inviting us to hold in awareness these things that almost can seem paradoxical. You know, you think it's going one way, and then your words take it the other way, and then the rhythm is going the other way. You know, and in all these ways, for the four of you, I just want to really bow with deep appreciation, because all of your works are incredibly healing for the world. You know, and I'll just make one pitch for the pandemic. This disruption of the loss of lives and livelihoods that we're experiencing is actually an opportunity. And we have a thing called the Pep Me Up community, which I invite you all to join. We can use this disruption as an opportunity to identify how modern culture with the lie of the separate self is killing us, and actually come to live a different way. So we can actually use this moment to bring healing to the planet.
Wow. Yeah. Just seen someone there in the chat said they're grateful already to have witnessed this panel. We are just about an hour in. I'm just ask everyone if they're still breathing and moving to take that little moment of digestion of all this good intellectual, emotional, spiritual nourishment. So a little practical thing before we go to people's questions, you might want to start upvoting questions that you like, participants. The leadership team of the conference decided just yesterday to give away recordings from our library to anyone working professionally in trauma who can't afford them. So if you can afford them, give us your money, because this conference isn't free. However, if you can't afford them, that's okay. We'll give you either a part discount or a full discount. So if you're someone that's going, oh my God, I want more of this, and you know, I work in, you know, with veterans, or I work with abuse survivors or refugees, then get on the Facebook group and you'll see on there a thread about how to do that. So we hope that is a gift. I wanted to say that before the end, because people often don't stay the full 90 minutes. Okay, so now we have lots and lots of wonderful questions here. The format I'm going to suggest is this, that I put one of the questions to the panel and two people answer it and take as long as you want. So enough of the a slightly agitating clock. Take as long as you want, but bear in mind, we'll get through more questions if you don't take an hour. So the top voted question is, what does one do when they resonate with the symptoms of trauma but cannot remember any experience from childhood, etc., no matter how much they try and remember? So which two of you might give that one a go?
Yeah. You know, go ahead.
Well, I think there's a common misunderstanding that people don't think they remember. They may not recall, but they remember. So there might not be conscious recall for all kinds of reasons that everybody in this panel could tell you about, which has to do with what's needed for conscious recall to be ingrained in the hippocampus and related parts of the brain. But the memory comes up in the body, and the memory comes up in the daily upsets that you experience, where the immediate cause is not at all proportionate to the degree of upset that you experience. So I'm not going to go more into it, except to tell you that there are ways of working with this. Now, that you can go into hypnosis, you can do psychedelic therapy, that'll often bring up memories. But I'm telling you, even without that, your memories of what happened to you show up every day in your life if you learn how to pay attention to it. And my work is very much related to doing that. The body will give you the messages. It's not true that you don't remember. Make the distinction between recall and remembering. They're very different things. The memory is always there. The recall may not be. Thank you.
Yeah. I think one of the problems has been a really misunderstanding of what trauma memory is about, and even what memory is about. And you were kind of alluding to what sometimes is called procedural memory or body memory. And these are things that our body does and continues to replay until we find an exit from that. And, you know, I was just thinking, often if I'm teaching a class, somebody will ask, well, what if the person can't remember the trauma? Can you work with that? And I said, well, actually, that's really what I work with, is what the person brings in terms of symptoms or hauntings and so forth. So I remember I was teaching a class in Jerusalem, both with Israeli and also with Palestinian people. That was before the last intifada, so it was possible to bring the group together. And so this one man, he fined me using his name. I don't think he's alive anymore. Anyhow, this man named Chaim Dasburg, he volunteered to a symptom that he had. And he's been having back pain for I think he said 30 years. So I started to work with the pain, but to have him become aware of the tensions that were underneath the pain. And he became aware of this really strong tension in his lower back. And I asked him, is one side more tense than the other? And he took a little bit more time to become aware. And then he said, yes. And I said, well, okay, if there are different tension, is there any movement that your body, that your spine is wanting to make? And so all of a sudden, he just started having sweat, waves of sweat. I mean, literally, there was on the floor in front of him, there was water from his sweat. And he would just take these very deep, easy breaths. He would tremble at times. And then at the end, when he opened his eyes and he said, "Do you want to know what happened?" I said, "Only if you want to tell me. And check on that. Just really see if you want to and tell me and also in the group." And he said, "Well, now I know what happened. 30 years ago, he was an army doctor, and they were a troop was going on together. They were in a truck and they were ambushed and everyone was killed, murdered except he. And he fell off the back of the truck and landed on his back. And as he worked through the procedural memory of that, the procedural and the emotional memory of that, the pain dissolved, it disappeared." There's one other thing about that, which I keep in my mind and in my heart, is, you know, I could see that all the people in the group were deeply affected. Again, except at the very end, there was no mention of what the trauma, specific trauma was. And so I remember people asking questions and giving feedback. And this one very handsome, very well-dressed Palestinian woman from Gaza Mental Health. And she stood up and she said, "Chaim, when you volunteered to come and work with Dr. Levine, I prayed that something terrible would happen, that you would become traumatized again, because you, your people, have humiliated my people, have tortured my people, have murdered my people, and I had only hate. But when I started just to feel in my body what was going on with your work, I realized, Chaim, until we find peace within ourselves, we'll never find peace with each other."
Yeah. Thank you. Please complete.
You know, and unfortunately, we weren't able to continue the work together because of the Intifada. But, you know, a number of the therapists there are still kind of working underground to bring people together from these previously warring peoples. And I see this as something that really the world needs in ways of healing each other. You know, the idea of the wars, to end wars, it just doesn't work that way, because the generational trauma, it gets passed through generation after generation after generation, until we can find the place to break that pattern, and so it doesn't have to continue forever. I'm finished now.
Okay, amen to that. Whew. Okay, I got another question here. It's got 67 people wanted this one looked at. What does one do when they resonate? Oh, just had that one, it's been up for, excuse me. Can you talk about the difference between a gut feeling, intuition, and a survival response, creating a story to pull you closer away from a situation, closer or away from a situation? So the difference between intuition and the survival response, creating a story. It's from Jose or Jose. So a couple of people to give that one a go. Dan.
Yeah, I'm happy to give it a start. Alanis, are you wanting to respond to this too? So you want to do this together?
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to begin?
You begin and I'll jump in.
Okay, so just to start, it's a really, really fantastic question, because, you know, just to stay a little bit neurological on us, to go into the bodies, the systems, you know, we're talking about a fight, flight, freeze, and faint set of reactions that are below the cortex. So the word we use is subcortical. And those can have a very, yeah.
Can we throw in, Peter, Dan, fight, flight, freeze, you're saying faint, collapse.
Faint, yeah.
What is the tend and befriend survival strategy?
So that's a different set of, those are higher cortical reactions. Yeah. And those are also important, but we'll start with the subcortical ones. But you're absolutely right. We have many cortical strategies. And I think a lot of what Dick talks about with different parts and different ways, and certainly out of UCLA, one of my colleagues there, you know, came up with this tend and befriend term, but it's not a subcortical process. It's a cortical one that, in her view, females have it. I think everybody has it, but our culture encourages it in females. That's my own take on it, that the cortex responds to cultural input. And so it's been assigned to a female way in the US, you know, where it's been studied. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole interesting thing about how we learn social lessons about what males are supposed to do or females are supposed to do, because that shapes.
And you said, sorry, at one point you said, in looking at the brain, female and male brains are the same. That was something I heard you say.
Well, yeah, so if we want to go there as a parenthetic, let's do this, you know, so in my reading of the scientific literature on male brains and female brains, what you see is if you put a scan up, let's say, to an expert and say, is this a female brain or a male brain, whether it's the function or the structure, they cannot tell. There are tendencies, for example, for there to be a bit more integration across the hemispheres and more differentiation in males, more integration in females, you know, what we can't say is that shaped by cultural inputs, because the research is very clear. The culture we're immersed in shapes the way the brain develops. So that's why, you know, people who are making their, you know, livelihoods on saying male brains and female brains are so different are missing the science of how culture shapes the brain. And we had a whole center we used to run at UCLA, you know, looking at this. So we're very careful scientifically about that. So that's parenthetically that view. So the fight, flight, freeze, and faint reactivity in terms of this question, you know, do push up from the subcortical areas up into the cortex. And so you do get an awareness of it. So it can feel like, you know, an automatic reaction that you're having. And then to get to the second part of the question, you know, literally around the gut, you have a neural network, and around the heart, you have a neural network. So recently I was teaching with Antonio Damasio, and what we were talking about was that the brain around the heart, that is a parallel distributed network, like a spider web-like network around the heart, and the spider web-like network around the gut are the first and second brains, the gut being the first, the heart being the second. And it's the third brain, which is the only one that has language with words, that calls itself the brain. So part of a way of understanding intuition is that it's literally the neural net processing around the gut and around the heart that also push themselves up through the first layer of the spinal cord called lamina one, and also the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, and they push up to an area of the brain called the insula, and they're driving themselves up through these subcortical areas. So it actually comes through very similar networks as your fight, flight, freeze, and faint reaction. So it can be very hard sometimes to say, is this a gut reaction that is just a leftover trauma, you know, of my reactivity or not? I have ideas of how to discern it, but let me just pass it to you, Alanis, at this moment, then I'll come back to, you know, ways you would distinguish those two, because there are ways, and Peter probably has ideas too about this.
For me, as a young person, I used to be, you know, what I would call highly intuitive was just sort of an emotional acting out or a reactivity. So for me, it became this drive to render more sophisticated my discernment of what's happening in my body and what the message actually is. So if I'm feeling a feeling, if I pause long enough, which is not always easy to do, to go to, was there a thought that preceded this sensation in my body? There's a high likelihood if the sensation of my body is tense or bound in some way, that the thought is either false or, you know, worthy of being investigated. So really being able to discern between intuition, which in some ways is us listening to source or sitting in self. That's my personal experience of it. So intuition can be this spiritual sort of leadership from within and this interiority. So discerning between feelings and intuition is a really powerful thing, because if I'm just going by feelings, I can ruin my whole life in one fell swoop in 20 seconds by saying, well, I was just following my heart, you know. Mm-hmm. And while it's important to listen to any kind of messages, and I love the what'd you call it, Dan? The three brains?
Oh yeah, the three brains, yeah.
The gut brain, the heart brain, the viscera. So being able to grow in discernment and sophistication in some ways of being more intrapersonally developed, that intelligence, developing an interiority. For those who are temperamentally sensitive and highly empathic, it's a little bit easier of an introverted, it's a little bit easier to go within because our interiority is so much a part of our world. For those of us who are more externally oriented, I would believe it would be a little more challenging to find out the difference between this feeling and this intuition. You know, and sometimes they work together. Sometimes my intuition, bottom up, creates a feeling, creates a thought, creates an image, has prophetic images for me to follow or avoid. So for me, a lot of times it's an intuitive response combined with feelings, because as you and I talked about, Richard, the idea that different parts can come in. So there might be this capital S self having an intuitive, visceral sense about something, body talking, top down, bottom up, combined with just feelings that may be born from false thoughts or misperceptions or a sense of disconnection from all of life. I mean, we started with this idea that on a very quantum physics level, we are made up of the same things, individuated in this funny dualistic realm. So we have this sort of play, this theater that you said earlier, of us interacting as though we are disconnected. But let's only use that individuation as a way to have this be a fun playground of sensuality. There's this whole new thing of pleasure activism for those of us who have survival strategies of being on our head too much or disassociating or whatever it is, to find a way to have interiority not be so scary. And one thing that did happen with my son when he was about 4, he was feeling a lot of feelings, and I said, let's go in and see what's happening. And he turned to me and he said, Mommy, it's so scary in there. And I said, you know what, it can feel scary, but you're not going in alone. I'm coming with you. So, you know, he basically said, okay. And then we went in, we really sort of in a gentle 4-year-old way, talked to these different parts. I love the book, Peter, your book, Trauma Proofing Your Kids is like a Bible for our family. So basically, you know, I could say more about this, but for me, it's about the sophistication of being able to discern where this sensation is coming from, what part is attempting to express themselves to me, what message from the body, Gabor, like who's talking. And then really important to know that if I feel something, that's not necessarily a green light to act on that feeling. It's more a green light to start a dialogue.
Yeah. You know,
go for it, Peter.
The question about gut feeling and gut intuition or survival reactions. I'm going to go add to what Dan was talking about. I'm going to put on my scientist hat for a little bit here. Actually, no, this is just it's kind of getting cold here in Maine for thin California blood. And this nerve, the vagus nerve that goes from the brainstem down through the whole interior of the body, and especially to the organs below the diaphragm, the gastrointestinal system. As Dan said, the gastrointestinal system has its own diffuse network, like a jellyfish or a sea anemone, but a lot of computing power. And so this nerve, it's the largest nerve in the body, that 80% of that nerve, and this is something that Charles Darwin knew long, long time ago, was sensory. So it's actually taking information from the guts and from the heart and relaying it up to the brain. Mm. So what happens, for example, if you leave your house and all of a sudden you see somebody fall on a bicycle or get hit by a car, and you go, you get this gut feeling, this gut sensation. And what happens is through the sensory part of that nerve, that yuck goes back up to the brainstem and gets amplified. So we start with, oh, and then it gets amplified to, ugh, and then, ugh. And then we are just in this positive feedback loop with negative consequences. And we're not with our instincts at all. And because that overrides the instincts. Now there's an exercise that I'll just, if it's okay, just take a few minutes to invite everyone to do, including all of you people who are, who are watching the program. And the idea is, how do we break that feedback loop where the sensations get yuckier and yuckier and yuckier? And I think at the very beginning, I talked about healing trauma as being able to find new experiences in our body that contradicted those of shutdown and overwhelming helplessness. And this is an exercise of just taking an easy, a full breath, and on the exhalation, making the sound vu, vibrating it in the area of your belly. So what we're doing is sending a new signal from the gut back up to the brain that says, this is over. You don't have to keep replaying this horror. So here's the exercise. I'll do it. And then anybody who wants to join. Now, I will say one thing, because it will very often bring up sensations or feelings. So again, I want you to know that if that happens, just see if you can connect with those sensations Dan was talking about with this, and Gabor too, with this part that really is caring, empathetic to ourselves. So here's the exercise: to take an easy full breath on the out breath to make the voo sound. And then when the breath is all the way out and the sound is all the way out, just allowing the new breath to come in, filling belly and chest. So I'll demonstrate it, and then anybody can do it with me, with all of us. And then let the breath come in, filling belly and chest. And once more. So please be free to join in.
Thank you, Peter. It's kind of like a choir. Yeah.
Yes, like a choir. And that's reconnecting ourselves to our intuitive self, the part that knows things very rapidly that the conscious mind would just fumble around with. Now, one thing about intuition.
I want to go to another question.
Okay, next time.
Thank you, sir. So, what can we learn from indigenous cultures in regard to how we deal with trauma? This is from Rodrigo. Richard, if you have anything on this, then feel free to jump in. If not, I've seen Gabor's hand up as well.
Yeah, I can speak to this. So I started hearing about these parts back in the early 80s and was intrigued. I didn't know anything about this, and clients were teaching it to me. And I started helping clients focus inside and doing these inner dialogues and so on. And at some point, this is probably about 4 or 5 years in, I started hearing about shamanism and how similar the experiences that shamans had talked about for centuries were to what we were encountering. And what some traditions were thinking of as demons sometimes turned out to be parts that had been forced into extreme roles, and we could actually interact with them in a way. And many shamanic traditions would rely on spirits to do the retrievals, but they would be doing retrievals in a very similar way to what we do in IFS. And a woman named Sandra Ingerman wrote a book that was influential to me at that time. And it started to occur to me that I had just found a way to enter the same world that many shamanic practitioners had been entering for a long, long time. And it was very validating because, as I say, many of the things we were encountering, I was reading about in some of the literature on shamanism. And the one difference I would say is that most of the traditions I read about didn't rely on what I call self to do the actual interacting and healing with the parts. It was more spirit guides and things like that. But I've always, in my writing and in teaching, tried to honor the shamanic traditions that knew about this long before I ran into it.
So let me tell you a personal story about this. I've been working for about over 10 years now with a plant called ayahuasca. Not as a shaman, I'm not anywhere close to that, but facilitating workshops. So I traveled to Peru 2 years ago now in July. This is after a speaking trip in the UK. And I was gonna lead a retreat at a place called the Temple of the Way of Light with native Shipibo, Amazonian, Peruvian healers. And about 23 people, therapists and psychiatrists and doctors, had paid big bucks to come and do this retreat where I was gonna facilitate it. And then the shamans were gonna do the ceremonies. The shamans did a ceremony with me and everybody else. And they said to me next morning, buddy, we can't have you in ceremony because you got so much trauma and so much stress built up in you that you're poisoning everybody else here. And so we can't help them when you're present because your energy is going to affect them. And they said, furthermore, you can't even work with them during the day. The ceremonies take place at night because even during the day, the same thing is going to happen. And not only that, you're absorbing all their trauma and all their energies. So they said, you're fired. So they fired me from my own retreat. These guys didn't know anything about me. They had no idea who I was, all these books I've written and, you know, that I know all these healers and where I've been and what I've done. They just knew that here was this medical gringo who was all stressed and hadn't taken care of himself. So they assigned one shaman to work with me for the next five ceremonies. And the other five shamans worked with the other 23 participants. I'm not going to tell you the end. It was beautiful. It was too long of a story. But I'm telling you, in one night, they picked up what it would have taken, I don't know how many psychiatrists, how many dozens of years to figure out. And they said to me, you had a big scare when you were very young. They knew nothing about my history. They said, you had a very big scare when you were very young, and you're still carrying it, they said. And finally, I'll just finish the story by telling you that they also said about the whole group, these psychiatrists and therapists and physicians. They said, when we deal with other people's trauma, we clear it out. We shamanically clear it out. We take care of ourselves. We have never seen such a stressed group as this group of healers, because you people don't take care of yourselves. These shamans, with their indigenous wisdom, picked up all that, and they did powerful work on all of us in 6 days. So that's my story.
Gabor, thank you. We are now almost at time, people. The last question I want to actually put out to the group, to the participants, so wisdom of the group and not just experts. What is your top fun self-care practice? So kind of a fun one to finish with. If everyone wants to write theirs in the chat, that might be kind of a fun one as we move towards wrap up here. Daniela, once that starts to slow down a little bit, then please put people's websites in. So if people want to find more about Richard, Gabor, Alanis, Dan, or Peter, put them in there. I'd ask everyone to forgive me my hosting foibles tonight. It wasn't the easiest job. I personally, though, I'm absolutely delighted with what these guys gave us. Just absolute gifts from all five of them. I feel like I could watch that about 10 times and I'd still be digesting wisdom that would improve my life. So just absolute gifts from all five of you. Often after kind of these kind of sessions, people want to chat. Luckily, we have a clever thing that can do that on the portal, which is free for all, called the coffee breaks. You don't have to drink coffee. You can drink tea or water or no beverage at all. The idea is that you click on the three dots on the top right of the portal. There's a little red coffee cup, and that will take you to a Zoom room. And particularly after ones about trauma, people are often a bit stirred up. It's kind of nice to see other human beings face to face, look them in the eye or look them on the camera and have a little chat about what's been going on. Do be a bit careful in terms of disclosure and things like that. You know, it's not a therapy session, but it's a nice way to just have a little chat after a session and discuss the ideas as much as anything. Of course, the Facebook group I mentioned that there are the free library for anyone who works professionally with trauma who can't afford it. So if you can, great, buy it. If you want 50% off or 100% off for anyone who's working with traumatized people, that feels like part of the gift we can give to the world. So there's how to do that is through Alina, the customer service person, through Facebook, or through just the customer service contact on the website. If you do want to get the whole library of recordings, you know, you can digest the 1,000 presenters, find exactly what you want. We've got so much good stuff coming up in terms of other speakers. Stephen Porges, for example, is coming up. Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen's interview and Judith Aston, David Buscelli from TRE fame. This is just tomorrow, by the way. Reverend Angel Williams is coming up. Sharon Salzberg, Ken Wilber. There's so much good stuff on at the conference, an absolute feast. And the library just means you can digest it. It's also a nice way to say thank you to us if you can afford it, just because, you know, it costs about $1 million to put this on. So it's appreciated if you can. Okay, Daniela, the hostess with the mostess, you're awesome as ever. You're doing a lot in the backgrounds that people don't know about that I can see. So anything I missed there, Daniela, anything you want to say?
No, just bumped away.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone for watching. Let's leave with all for the book. In one word, what's the piece about trauma that people normally miss? So what's the piece about trauma that people normally miss in one word? So anyone at all, start with just one word for the book.
Okay, one sentence. Bad news, trauma is a fact of life. Good news, it doesn't have to be a life sentence.
Beautiful. Okay, we'll give everyone a sentence. I'm trying to find the line between being too strict and not strict enough. One sentence, Alanis.
Many things. I mean, it's case by case. And as we talked about earlier, it's every single human has a different inquiry from moment to moment. Grief is a big one. I see a lot of people acting out in war and discord and conflict that doesn't correct or doesn't resolve. So much of it is a fear of grief. A lot of divorce, you know, a lot of court, divorce, custody, those cases that I hear about a lot. So much of it is the resistance to crying and grieving. So much more, but that's my one sentence.
Thank you. Richard, what do people normally miss?
That you can't, well, capital S self is in everybody, can't be damaged, knows how to heal, and is there regardless of how much trauma you suffer.
Gabor.
From my point of view, what people miss about trauma is that it exists as a reality. So this is a fact that's missed in the medical world. The average medical student does not receive a single lecture on trauma in 4 years of school. It's missed in the legal world, it's missed in education. Kids are punished and excluded because they act out their traumas. So in a word, what's missed about trauma in this society is its very existence and its multiple impacts.
Thank you. Dan, what do people normally miss?
Yeah, I think people miss the central role of love. Mm-hmm. That, integration made visible is love, kindness, and compassion. And that's the work together we can also bring together into this world.
Okay, we are on time. Thank you from myself, really from my heart, from Daniela, and I know from so many of us watching. You know, Daniela and myself have both served in Afghanistan, for example, and Palestine and different places. And this is really important to us, this work, really important to us. So thank you to all five of you. Thank you to the audience. Thank you for everyone that's involved with the conference. We will see you again soon. So take it easy.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Nice being with you. Really nice being with you.
Oh, great to be with you all.
Give me a ring when you can. I'm wondering about your, give me a ring. You have my number? Or an email or whatever. I want to just be in contact with you and see what you're up to these days.
Do you mean me?
Of you, actually. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll all be meeting if we have the International Conference, SE Trauma Conference. Mm-hmm. I guess it's going to be postponed to next autumn. But anyhow, I'm looking forward to seeing y'all there.
I'll reach out. Yeah. Love you. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Stay safe. Mm-hmm.